Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Giustina. With us and back again, State Senator James Skoufis, a Democrat from New York's 42nd District. He is the chair of the Senate Committee on Investigations and Government Operations. Welcome back, Senator.
Great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I was looking into your bio a little bit, and we haven't talked about this, I don't think, on the Capital Connection, but it's instructive, I think, and I wondered if you might expand upon it. You spent the first many years of your life in New York City in public housing, one generation removed from food stamps. And, you know, that experience must inform how you look at issues in the state. And I'm imagining you're glad when you see efforts by the legislature, for example, in the last budget, try to get this housing bill passed, which they did.
Yeah, look, everyone's background and upbringing, where they come from, is instructive to who they are. And certainly I'm no exception. Before moving up to Orange County with my family, in elementary school, yes, I grew up in NYCHA housing. I was on Casino Boulevard, the Pamanok public housing projects, and which was a working class development. And certainly, you know, I've seen now two perspectives, both in my case, very much connected, where you know you come from a background where you know it's hardworking. My dad was an immigrant with his family coming here from Greece, and in really their case came here with nothing. On my mom's side, as I just said, my mom and her family grew up in NYCHA, New York City public housing. I've got that perspective. I come from that background, but my parents, my family, they worked hard to get to the middle class, and then we moved to the suburbs. And I've seen what that transition looks like. I've lived it through my parents, through my family, and that is something I'd like to think I bring to the legislature. What can I be doing every day to help people get to the middle class and to remain in the middle class, because that's where my family comes from. So yes, I appreciate you bringing that up, and that is certainly instructive to what I do in the legislature.
But it is also true still, too, that we just don't have enough housing, do we?
There's no question about it. And in fact, I just saw some data a couple of days ago where I think it's in Austin. It's one of the major Texas cities. Their rents have dropped double digits. And it's become incredibly more affordable. It's still expensive, but incredibly more affordable to be able to live in Texas. And why is that? The two dots is a straight line between them. They built a lot more housing over the past decade. This is not rocket science, ladies and gentlemen. This crisis is a supply and demand crisis. You have a really big pool of people who are looking for more affordable housing, and you have a really tiny pool of affordable housing units. And so what do we have to do? We have to build more of them. Of course, that has to come in a responsible manner. The growth has to be intelligent. You shouldn't be building high-rise apartment complexes on cul-de-sacs with single-family homes. But this is a very straightforward, simple supply and demand problem.
And shouldn't we also reclaim some of the properties that maybe were lost? Like during COVID, I saw an article about pharmacies. Some pharmacies have closed, and those buildings are sitting there vacant. There's an opportunity, isn't there? I've seen churches turned into apartment buildings, old schools turned into apartment buildings, right?
We have to be creative, to your point. And you know, the most glaring example of what you're describing is in New York City, you still have thousands and thousands of office spaces that post-COVID, with many people continuing to work remotely, are sitting there vacant. We should be transitioning those types of spaces into affordable housing units. They're just sitting there. Other opportunities, some of which you described, they're just sitting there. So in some cases, you don't even need to pour foundation and build new buildings. You've got opportunity staring you right in the face today.
Well, something that today has been completed, and you and I spoke about it the last time you were on, and so I'm glad to get this update on the Crash Gate. Explain to our listeners again what that is, what it will do, and why it occurred in the first place.
That's right. We did talk about it the last time I was on, and you know, this really started to get a lot of attention. This Crash Gate concept is an emergency access route onto a highway, I-84, here in Orange County. And this really started to get a lot more attention after, your listeners may remember, there was a really tragic bus crash or accident, a spillover, here in Orange County. Students from Long Island traveling through the state into Pennsylvania for some sort of summer activity, summer camp, and the bus flipped over. And one of the issues was that the most proximate fire department, the most proximate first responders, had to travel miles and miles to get to the nearest on-ramp onto the highway and then double back to get to the site of the crash. Whereas if there was an access point, a crash gate, if you will, they could have shaved off many minutes and perhaps saved a couple of the lives that were tragically lost. So, you know, this has been an issue for, quite frankly, over two decades. This fire department has been looking for this access point. Following the tragedy, I and others really spotlighted this problem. And we're grateful that DOT, the state administration, working with the Federal Highway Administration, in terms of government speed, it was as if we were at like Mach 5 speed here. It took about a year, but for government, especially when you're involving state and federal government, we moved extremely fast. The gate is now operational, and that highway is now safer as a result of the project.
Do us a favor, benchmark that fast process and apply it to all other public expenditures.
That's right. I mean, not to make light of the situation, but to your point, it is so frustrating, to the point where how many years now have we been repairing the steps leading to the front facade of the state capitol building? It takes us 4 or 5 years to repair steps on government buildings. So to do this in a year was really gratifying. And to your point, hopefully we can extrapolate this experience and apply it to all public works projects.
Well, I know one of the areas that many of your constituents are concerned about, and certainly our listeners are all concerned about this, but they'll understand why I mentioned your area, and that's energy costs. Central Hudson has announced again another rate hike proposal. They had a lot of problems down in that area. We've been covering this issue, and you've spoken about it among a number of lawmakers in the Hudson Valley. How can people survive with this kind of energy cost?
It's a great question. And for some people, the answer is they can't. And that's what we need to focus on here. It is astonishing to me, in the worst possible sense of the word, that on the heels, I'm talking days later, on the heels of being given approval, which they never should have gotten, by the Public Service Commission for a significant rate hike, they put in a new application days later for another rate hike. Usually, utilities, they wait several years, at least a couple of years, before they return to the Public Service Commission, New York State government, and ask for an additional rate hike. This was days later. And what really is insulting here, this is just, it's appalling, it's disgusting. I'm not going to mince words on this issue. What is really, really disgusting is that for the past several years, Central Hudson has been in the news for all the wrong reasons. They were sending out bills that were so erroneous. They were, you know, doing this estimated meter reading, and people had no idea what to actually pay. And then the next month, when they got the real meter reading, their bill would be $1,500 when it should be $600. This has been a complete fiasco of a company for the past several years, to the point where they were under investigation. They were slapped with enormous fines and have been in the limelight, and to some extent, government has been trying to hold them accountable, although not nearly accountable enough. And so in light of all that, they get a rate hike, which they never should have gotten, and then they apply for a new additional one days later. It is insulting, to your point, which is the most important point. People can't afford it. And when these executives, and they've got a new executive team, come in and tell me, we are, you know, working on all of these issues, we're trying to turn a new leaf, we understand people's frustrations, well, you know, it's nice to talk the talk, but you're not walking the walk. In fact, you're walking backwards. This is disgraceful. And to the extent that this application continues through the process, I'm certainly going to be doing everything I can to make sure they get a big fat 0% increase from the Public Service Commission.
Now, they're a monopoly there, aren't they?
Most of these utilities are monopolies, and that's really the fundamental problem. So my Senate district in Orange County is primarily split between two utilities. You've got Central Hudson, and then you've got Orange and Rockland utilities. And really, you know, these utilities have their own jurisdictions, their own service territories. There is nothing that I'm aware of that precludes competition in law, state or federal or otherwise. But what kind of happens, it seems to me, is that these utilities, they have this like unspoken, unwritten, I guess it is spoken, but it's unwritten agreement where it's like you stay
collusion.
Out of our area.
We call
and,
that collusion.
We'll stay out of, that's right. I believe it's collusion. You stay out of our area, we'll stay out of your area. And that is what happens. And the biggest loser by far is the ratepayer, the customer, my constituents, everyone's constituents. That, I believe, is collusion. And if we're ever going to really, truly, fundamentally fix this problem, that is what we have to fix.
Sounds like an investigation for the chair of the Committee on Investigations to me.
We actually did a significant investigation, released a significant investigative report following you, your listeners, and you may remember.
No, I do.
A couple of winters ago, there was an enormous price surge.
Yes.
And that's really where we have flatlined. That's the new sort of normal now. But it started a couple of winters ago with an enormous price surge. And that's when we opened the investigation. We examined many of these utilities over the course of many months. We came forward with, I believe, a lot of instructive and important solutions, some of which have passed the Senate, some of which we're still working on. But it's an outrageous situation, and I believe it is collusion.
We're speaking with State Senator James Skoufis. He's a Democrat from New York's 42nd Senate District, and he is joining us on the Capitol Connection this week. I'm David Gustina. Now, one of the investigations you have updated us on in the past is on IDAs. This is industrial development agencies. And you have not been afraid to fight with local officials, in some cases, some pretty strong war of words going back and forth. What's going on now?
Yeah, so for your listeners who may not be aware of what an IDA is, every county and some local governments have an industrial development agency, an IDA. And these are the agencies that are tasked with providing tax breaks, mostly property tax breaks, to select corporations. And, you know, ostensibly on paper, what the mission is supposed to be is, well, when a company is looking at possibly, leaving the state, or if it's a new project considering several different areas, let's incentivize them to bring them and their jobs and their economic activity to our local community. That ostensibly is the mission. But what we have found, inarguably, what we have found in many cases, including where I am in Orange County, is that these agencies do not do the due diligence, do not fact check and dig in and determine whether the tax breaks are needed for the project to happen. And so in Orange County, they just hand them out like Tic Tacs. everyone that walks through their doors, here's a property tax break. And in many of these cases, they're not warranted, they're not needed for the project to happen. There are several examples of me intervening, getting involved, pushing aside the corporate applicant, and lo and behold, the project still happens without the tax break after they've subsequently withdrawn their application to the IDA. And so, yes, it's a bad situation. Taxpayers are getting ripped off because at the end of the day, guess who makes up the difference when there's a property tax break given out to a corporate project that's unwarranted? Guess who makes up that difference? Everybody else. All of the taxpayers, all the homeowners, all the small businesses who are in many cases living paycheck to paycheck. And so in Orange County, we actually have first one ever in the state. I got it in last year's budget. We actually have a state appointed monitor here in the Orange County IDA. He was appointed several months ago. He's doing a great job. He has veto power. He is there on behalf of taxpayers in Orange County, and if he sees the Orange County IDA is trying to rip off taxpayers and advance a bad deal, he can overturn those decisions. And so taxpayers have a full-time watchdog looking over their shoulders now, which is great news for the people of Orange County.
One of the things that we've seen, and I don't know if we credit this to the pandemic or not, but it's this retail theft that's been going on. You see it where people go into even like a supermarket or a store in the mall in groups, sometimes alone, and they just start taking stuff off the shelves. And in most cases, smartly, the people who run these businesses say, you know, don't mess with these people. You don't know, you could get hurt. But they end up walking out with hundreds, if not thousands of dollars worth of merchandise. And I know there's been some move on retail theft in New York. Your thoughts on it and the need for public protection in an area which is a new phenomenon, really?
Yeah, so this was a big issue in the budget this year that was subject to heated negotiation. And to your point, retail theft has been a persistent problem. The data bears it out, not just here in New York, but it's a national trend. Unlike a lot of other crimes, and in particular, violent felonies that have seen a decline, contrary to some belief, over the past several years, there are many nonviolent felonies that have been persistently either increasing or level. We haven't been able to really put a dent in. And retail theft, petty larceny, shoplifting is one of the most persistent trends, unfortunately. And so we took this up in the budget. We did a couple of, I think, important things, both of which I strongly supported and helped get across the finish line. One is when a lot of these shoplifting events occur, oftentimes, unfortunately, there's an assault that's associated with them on the employees or the retail workers that are in these shops. And one of the things we did in the budget was we made those assaults now a felony. They were only a misdemeanor, believe it or not, prior to enactment of the budget. And the second thing, and this one's really important. So these criminal rings, the organized outfits that are sending out individuals on a daily or near daily basis to rob these stores, they're very aware of what the state laws are, and they're mindful of how much they can steal before they trigger a felony. So prior to the budget. And I think the threshold was about $1,000. If you're an individual and you shoplifted under $1,000 worth of goods, you can only be charged with a misdemeanor. If it's over $1,000, roughly, whatever that number is, then you could be prosecuted for a felony. But the problem, or one of the problems, was that on Monday you go out and steal $900 from the Rite Aid. On Tuesday, the criminal ring sends you out and you steal another $900 from the CVS on Tuesday, and so on and so on.
Senator,
and all you could be charged with is a misdemeanor.
Senator, it happened to us, not in that way, but through our property tax check that we paid. Our property tax bill was stolen through the mail system. And they knew, we were told later, this was a ring, and they knew how much to steal so they wouldn't trigger a federal investigation. So just what you said, they steal just under the amount, and they do it one after another, and they make millions at it.
And incredible.
So yeah. Now we have these organized people doing this, but I'm also worried about just the everyday folks. You see this wearing away of adherence to the laws.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And, you know, we did something about this, though, in the budget, I'm glad to say. So we put in what I'll call an accumulator tool for prosecutors. And so in the instance that I described, in the instance that you're referring to, you all are living it, it sounds like firsthand, like so many others. In these instances, now in New York State, prosecutors can add up the value of the goods over multiple shoplifting or theft-related charges. And so if it's $900 on Monday and $900 on Tuesday, the prosecutor can come in and say, well, you're over $1,000 now, it's $1,800, and we're going to be pressing charges for a felony. So you know, we're providing some additional tools. You know, these may not seem like world-changing things, but these are very important tools for prosecutors to hold these individuals rightly accountable.
I should finish my story by saying, you know, our money was FDIC insured, and so therefore, because we filed a police report, we filed the steps, the credit union reimbursed us. So just a word to everyone should that happen to you. Now, let's talk about something completely different. Congestion pricing plan. The governor suspended that. I know where you are, and many of the issues for lawmakers close to New York City, they were worried about, again, like we're talking with energy, essentially a tax, $15 to take your car down into lower Manhattan. The governor suspended that. Where are you on all this?
I'm relieved. I'm thankful for the outcome here. My constituents and I were appalled by the prospect of this new tax, and it is a tax. And look, you know, I've seen some of the advocates in New York City, transit advocates, up in arms. Oh, the governor. Oh, you know, James Skoufis and other legislators. You know, they just love cars, and you know they just want to shovel and funnel more cars into our community. It's got nothing to do with that. Here's what it has to do with: two things. Number one, it's not just $15. It's $15 in this new toll, yes, but it's also then $15 to get over the George Washington Bridge. It's $20 from Orange County round trip in gas. And so for a working person in Orange County to drive into New York City, it's a $50 bill for the privilege, and that's before you get to anything else. You might have to pay for parking, you know, certainly if you're there, you're, you know, whatever, meals, you know, the normal stuff. $50 just to get to and from New York City, an hour north, here in Orange County. But here's the real rub. Here's the real rub. Ostensibly, congestion pricing is supposed to, I'm told by the supporters, you know, nudge people out of their cars, take the train instead, disincentivize folks from driving into New York City, where no doubt there is lots of congestion. All you need is, you know, two working eyes to be able to see that. Now, here's the rub in Orange County. We don't have a train into New York City. We have one measly, terrible train line that terminates in New Jersey. And then you've got to meander around the Secaucus Junction, you know, complex to a different station, a different platform, wait for the train, and then you're eventually brought into Penn Station. Then you probably have to get on subways, too, to get to wherever you're going. And so, you know, we don't even have a train. And by the way, you can go 6 hours in the middle of the day in Orange County without a single train taking us from Orange County to Secaucus Junction in New Jersey. And so there are no trains for us to say, oh, yes, okay, we don't want to pay the toll, we'll just hop on a convenient train. Does not exist. And so if the transit folks and the MTA and all these, you know, the small minority of folks who are cheering a $15 toll, if they want to build me a one-seat ride from Orange County into Penn Station with trains every 45 minutes like it's across the river, then fine, let's have the conversation. Until that day, my folks have to drive, in most cases, into New York City, and $50 is too much money. It's outrageous. So I'm glad that the governor pumped the brakes on this.
We're running out of time quick. Senator Skoufis, I see the governor has called for a climate summit. She's invited a number of different groups in, and I'm guessing you're supportive of it. But I see that, for example, the Business Council of New York State says you got to reevaluate this, trying to reach your goals because they're worried about the costs associated with making the transition. At the same time, we're seeing more flooding, tornado records, you know, everything else is happening that leads us to believe we need to do something. Will you be able to get some input on this?
I sure hope so. I would expect so. Look, the legislature's been active on climate change, on this issue generally. And as far as the summit goes, you know, I think the more conversation that we can have on this viscerally important issue, the better. We should welcome it. You know, it is clear we are not on track to meet our goals under our 2019 landmark climate change legislation. That's highly problematic. And so, yeah, I think we do need to convene a summit. I think we need to figure out what exactly is going on, why we're falling short, it seems, on hitting those targets, and what do we have to do? And yes, we absolutely, part of the equation here is we have to be mindful of the costs. There is a significant transition involved here, and we have to make sure that working class, middle class New Yorkers are insulated from any heavy-handedness along the way, because we, as we all know, we already live in a high tax, high cost of living state. We can't exasperate that, but we do have to talk about getting off fossil fuels. The climate is, no question, empirically warming. There's more flooding. There are more tornadoes, like you said, including very recently, just the other day, another one here in New York, which is not something that we ever saw or talked about until recently.
City of Buffalo.
And so we have to deal with this.
Yeah. Well, just a minute left. I want to get your reaction to the presidential election coming up, but that impacts New York Congress. I'm guessing you're feeling a little bit more enthusiastic now that there's been a transition from President Biden to Kamala Harris, the vice president, and now vice presidential pick Tim Walz, the governor of Minnesota.
Look, it was a classy, patriotic move on the part of President Biden to pass the torch. I can't even imagine, no one I think can imagine, really, if we're being honest, how painfully difficult that decision must have been for him. And yes, there's a lot of excitement. I have not seen this level of excitement in the Democratic Party in many, many years, in quite a number of election cycles. And Tim Walz, you know, the way I described him, I think the way a lot of people are describing him right now is he's like everybody's dad. He's everyone's grandfather. He's someone that you can relate to from your family who, and this is so important, who just comes off and seems to be normal, who seems to be like a real person. Oftentimes we look at politicians, elected officials, and they seem disconnected. They seem like they're testing, they're polling every word before it comes out of their mouth. This guy just seems like a normal human being, which is refreshing, it's wonderful, and it's generating a lot of this excitement we're seeing.
He is Senator James Skoufis, a Democrat from New York's 42nd Senate District. He is also the chair of the Senate Committee on Investigations and Government Operations. Senator Skoufis, we appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, and you enjoy summer.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. You can listen to The Capital Connection anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. And join us again next week at this same time for another political conversation. For The Capital Connection, I'm David Giustina.
Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.